Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Bailey v. Roop. Mr. Rose.
Thank you, and may it please the Court. Federal regulations and the consent decree in this case require that the state of Indiana develop Medicaid applicants' complete medical histories prior to the issuance of a disability determination. The plaintiffs met their burden of demonstrating contempt by showing that the state has implemented a policy whereby it routinely fails to collect applicants' complete 12-month histories. Met with these undisputed facts, the district court nonetheless concluded that the requirements of the consent decree were being met by a policy whereby the state has deemed that a complete medical history, as that term is used in federal regulations, does not necessarily require the collection of a single medical record. This conclusion was erroneous as a matter of law, and the district court's decision should be reversed.
Can I just start you out? Is it really your position that the plain meaning of that directive to collect the records covering at least the 12 months preceding the application means the totality of all medical records and nothing less? In other words, you know, suppose the state collects 100 pages of medical records on an applicant's medical visits, but fails to obtain 2 pages of medical information for a tangentially related condition. Is the state in violation of the Medicaid regulation?
That is absolutely correct, Your Honor. What we have to remember is that these are Social Security.
I don't understand. What is correct? The question is correct? What's the answer to the question?
The answer is that under that circumstance, the state would be in violation of federal Medicaid law and the consent decree in this case.
What about medical files for completely unrelated conditions? Does the state have to compile an applicant's medical files for, like, the treatment of a rash when she claims a disability for blindness?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe the state does. This is something that the Social Security Administration deals with every single day and has no problem collecting 12 months' worth of medical records. The fact of the matter is that it is impossible to determine whether a condition is minor or major or related or unrelated until the state actually has that medical record in their hand. But this is the fundamental issue in this case, which is what exactly is a complete medical history. A complete medical history a medical history is not complete if it consists only of a summary form of the state's own creation. And what we're dealing we're not dealing with that instance. We're dealing with several instances in which the state has determined that a 7-page form that it created suffices in lieu of any medical records. A medical history is simply not complete unless it also contains the actual records of an applicant's diagnosis, treatment, and care.
So, Mr. Rose, it's your position then that there's no gap allowed. If we're dealing with a 50-year-old male who broke his arm at the age of 9 and that treatment for the setting of the arm is not included, you would say that that's any error of omission would result in a conclusion of incompleteness.
Any error or omission, Your Honor, within the past 12 months. Medicaid regulations define a complete medical history as dating back 12 months before the application. In the event that someone was treated at age 9 and applies at age 50, that certainly falls without the state's duty in this regard.
On the other hand, if the state missed by 1 month, let's say a critical document was needed in the 13th month, it was treatment and was apt, that'd be okay?
The state's obligation is to collect 12 months' worth of medical history.
My point is I just want to see what flex, if any, is there.
Your Honor, in the event that the state is not able to render an accurate disability determination based only on the 12 months' worth of medical records, then it is under an obligation to go back to a previous time period. But those 12 months, that requirement exists in every single case, unless the applicant states that their disability did not start until sometime during that period, which is an instance not at issue in any of the files in this case. The trouble for the state in this case is that federal regulations actually define what a complete medical history is, and they say that it must consist at a minimum of the past 12 months' worth of medical records from an applicant's providers. The command of controlling regulations in this regard is unequivocal. However, notwithstanding this command, rather than collect or even attempt to collect applicants' complete 12-month histories, the state of Indiana has begun requiring only a single form that in actuality is oftentimes left largely incomplete. The legality of this policy is thus betrayed by the plain language of federal regulations and has not been accepted by a single court in any jurisdiction. These regulations thus guard against the underdevelopment of Medicaid applications by setting a floor below which this development simply may not fall. The practical consequences of permitting the state to determine its own floor may be readily seen in several of the files adduced during a statistically significant random sampling in this case. In 9 applications, or fully a third of the random sampling, the state refused to collect the applicant's actual 12-month medical histories, in 8 of those instances opting instead for a summary form, as I say, of its own creation.
You said refused. You mean they had an opportunity and just didn't do it, or they openly rejected it? What do you mean?
Your Honor, the applicants at the time of application provide to the state of Indiana their treating facilities. Whether we call it a refusal or a failure is quite frankly insignificant. What's clear is that they are not requesting or they are not obtaining the past 12 months' worth of medical records from providers. In several of the instances in which the state required only the summary form or obtained only the summary form, it did not even require a completed summary form, instead opting for a form that was left largely incomplete, that was missing pages, or in one case that was completed by a registered nurse rather than a physician. And perhaps most startling, in one instance, the state opted for this summary form, even though the summary form was left entirely blank and unsigned, as well as a prescription refill pertaining to 1 of 3 disclosed disabilities, not 1 iota of evidence having been collected pertaining to either of the other 2 disabilities. It is certainly noteworthy, then, that this is not a case in which the state is arguing that the development that we see during the random sampling is anything out of the ordinary. Rather, the state is arguing that in each and every one of these instances, it collected enough information to decide that the applicant was not disabled. It collected enough information for its purposes. However, rather than permitting the state to exercise unbridled discretion in deciding when the medical development suffices, federal regulations set a floor below which this development simply may not fall. They are required, at the very least, to collect the past 12 months' worth of medical records from an applicant's providers. And this is a requirement that the undisputed facts demonstrate has not been and is not being met in Indiana right now. That said, the state's only proffered justifications for its policy in this case are made contemporaneously with its assertions that it is not even required to collect applicants' complete 12-month histories. As such, particularly in light of the fact that there can be no justification for a violation of controlling law, these justifications carry very little weight. A finding of contempt is therefore warranted, and the district court's decision should be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rose. Mr. Steiner.
May it please the court. To say the least, we disagree with the contention of the appellants, the plaintiffs in this case, that they proved their case of contempt in the district court. Obviously, the district judge didn't agree with that assessment, looking at the evidentiary submissions that were made by the parties. I would start with the comment that clearly in this kind of proceeding, the plaintiffs have the burden of proving their case, proving that the defendants were in contempt, that and they have to prove that the decision of the district court was either clearly erroneous or an abuse of discretion. That wasn't done.
Of course, there is no clear Seventh Circuit precedent on that issue, is there?
There is not. But I would also say this. There's no clear precedent supporting the plaintiffs on any of the claims that they make in this case. I would start with the point that
the First Circuit, let me think, the First Circuit and some of the district courts do say that reasonable diligence is an affirmative defense to a contempt petition.
That's true in terms of the standard, yes.
You, meaning the state, would bear the burden of proof.
I would say that even in those cases, though, if we look at them closely, there had to be at least an initial determination that there was some sort of violation. Those cases didn't deal with exactly the same kind of, you know, subject matter that we have here, the gathering of these records. They dealt with something that was maybe more clear-cut. And, you know, there was a determination made early on that there was a failure to comply with the order. And then to the extent that the decisions are saying that you could show, you know, reasonable compliance, it was after essentially that initial determination has been made. And that wasn't made in this case. And, in fact, you know, this is a point I kind of wanted to make. This order is not all that, you know, the consent decree or the regulations, for that matter, are not all that clear-cut. Generally, when we determine that a party is in contempt, as this court said in that Galuba case, it's because there's a clear command, an unambiguous command of some sort, to do something, and then it's not being done. Here, we're talking about something that's very complex. Gathering records in an environment where we have to get voluntary cooperation from the applicant, from the medical providers, in order to obtain the records that we need to have to make a decision. And all of this has to be done in a certain time period. I understand that the time period is 90 days. So in this case, and we've indicated this in our brief, we have procedures in place to diligently obtain the records. You start with the application. On the application, there's this form that opposing counsel indicated where medical providers are listed, persons, medical providers, institutions where care may have been given. When that is done, then the evidence in this case shows that the Medicaid agency sends out requests for information along with this questionnaire to these medical providers. Then information is sent back in. Then there is a second request if the response was inadequate. And the applicant is asked to participate in the process to help obtain the necessary records. So
yeah,
we have
but forgive me. What do you say to the argument that the people who are harmed by the state's noncompliance are often not in a position to pursue the matter further? So the state's error will not only likely harm the applicant, but the errors are likely to go undetected and unchallenged.
Well, I would answer that by saying I don't think there's anything in this record that indicates that Indiana's Medicaid agency has developed any procedures or taken any steps in any of the sample cases that we've looked at with any sort of intention to harm anyone. And, of course, that's not the standard.
No, that's not.
But nevertheless, there's simply no evidence in any way that the agency is not trying to do its best to gather the information. Again, I say when we look at these regulations, it's not so clear-cut. The requirement is for the agency to do its best to attempt to obtain the medical history for 12 months.
I really understand this, but, you know, ordinarily, we place the burden of demonstrating evidence in the hands of the party most able to demonstrate. And in this case, it's hard for the plaintiffs to acquire the evidence as to whether the state defendants had demonstrated reasonable diligence in acquiring medical records. I mean, that's a whole other case in and of itself.
Well, I'm not sure whether it's it may be difficult, but I wouldn't say it would be impossible if there was evidence out there.
Well,
I'm
not going to bring my own personal situation into this, but oh my goodness. It's hard. It can be very hard.
Sure. I'm not saying that it can't be difficult in the situation where you're dealing with individuals' medical records and need to keep information confidential to some degree and all of those kind of things. Of course, we want to maintain that confidentiality and we don't want to intrude on individuals.
Does the consent decree in this case contain any provision that exempts de minimis failures by the state?
It doesn't specifically say that, of course. On the other hand, it essentially does very little bit more than require the state to comply with the existing law. The requirements themselves were to gather the 12-month medical history, which is required by the regulations. However, those regulations have to be read in terms of the fact that this is a voluntary system of obtaining these records. You send out information requests. You send out a second request. You send a second follow-up after that. You try to get as much information as you can. If parties won't cooperate at all, you may have to dismiss a case. That's not what happened in any of the particular files that we have in this case. But if they don't cooperate, you know, when you ask for cooperation, when they just absolutely will not give you the records, et cetera, you're not going to be in a position to make the kind of determination that you want to make on the merits of the particular claim.
How much burden is on the plaintiff? It seems that because, you know, everybody has their own medical things. We've all been through it. I have. And there are some times that people go to clinics and helping poor people and that sort of thing. And so they get this request. This is not a regular patient. It's someone that's treated there from time to time. Others go to emergency rooms. It's very unlikely they're going to get very much cooperation from those providers because they don't have very much. And it's miscellaneous. It's not like you have a regular patient. Now, some may be the case. How much burden is on the plaintiff itself to get this stuff?
The regulations indicate there is some burden on the patient, on the applicant for the disability. There has to be some burden on them to assist in doing this because the agency doesn't have the power to compel the provider to provide the information. So there's no contempt power in the agency and no ability to take action of that sort against the provider if they won't cooperate. But what they do is follow what the regulations require, as I understand. They do make the request. They follow up. They follow up again. And as the files in this case actually indicate, the 26 files that was looked at, they do get a sizable amount of information back. And in most cases, they get back sufficient information to permit them to make a valid decision about the disability claim.
Well, would you concede the cases that Mr. Rose noted where two of the seven pages of the form were blank and the form was completed by an RN rather than a physician, or the application where the form was entirely blank and the only medical record was a copy of a prescription bill, would you concede that?
We've talked about those things in our complaint regarding the prescription. I think that the judge's use of that term prescription is probably too narrow. The record actually shows that it was an emergency room record of several pages. That's all that the community hospital had apparently regarding records regarding this individual. The agency in that particular case asked the provider to fill out a 251A, this questionnaire that can provide the medical history. The provider apparently didn't fill that out, sent it back blank, but attached the records that it did have. And the only provider that was listed in that particular case was this community hospital. So the record would indicate that the agency following procedure would have followed up, obtained what it could through the procedure, the request and the follow-ups. This is what they obtained. It appeared to contain enough information, ultimately, to make a decision about this person's claim, and so they made a decision. That's what? That one. The other, excuse me.
I
don't want to interrupt you at all.
No,
but
I don't want to interrupt
the
you.
Other one, as I understand, if you look at the evidence that the state filed, and, you know, we didn't have an evidentiary hearing in this case. This was just submissions by both sides with the judge looking at those things. So there hasn't been ultimate, you know, conclusions of fact regarding all these matters. And I really think that what the agency said, you know, needs to be looked at as carrying some weight. And the agency said about this other particular matter that in looking at other records in the case, there was a completed 251A, this questionnaire, at some point in time in the file. The discovery of these files occurred sometime after the, you know, decisions were made. For one reason or another, the completed 251A was not in the file at the time. But, you know, the evidence that the agency had, looking at requests that were made, other things that were done, the individual that's in charge of the review team, this Courtney O'Neill, testified through her affidavit that there would have been a completed 251A in the file at one point in time. It wasn't at the time of discovery. And I'd like to say something about that 251A. It's not the position of Indiana's Medicaid agency that completion of the 251A is all that they're seeking at all when they're sending out these medical requests. What they're seeking is the 12-month medical history for individuals. So they send out this form, which is a questionnaire that permits, in many cases, a treating physician to explain a person's 12-month medical history. They also seek the records. In many of these cases, you know, in some of the cases, 12 of the 26 were never disputed. In another 5 of the cases, the district judge looked at the records and said, my goodness, there's ample records here for a 12-month history. So in 17 of the 26, there's no question that there was things like the completed 251A and a sizable numbers of records. So it's not the goal of the agency just to get back a completed 251A. What the agency is trying to get is a 12-month medical history. It's trying to get the necessary follow-ups that may be needed. It's trying to obtain the information necessary to make a decision. That's what their goal is in these cases. So in these particular cases, these 26 cases, what the agency did is that they determined that there was sufficient evidence in these cases for them to, after gathering, going through the process, seeking, soliciting the records, and doing what they can to get the records, there was sufficient evidence for them to make determinations. And, of course, we're only looking at the files where there were denials. Of course, you know, the majority of cases are granted when they come through. And, of course, we don't really know what those files look like. But we do know from the 26 that we have that there is a lot of records gathered in most cases.
What rate of compliance does the state believe would indicate reasonable compliance?
Well, in this, I think that we would argue that what the district judge found here was reasonable. The district judge basically said, and we would agree with this, there's no hard and fast rule about what needs to be in each one of these medical files. So she determined that there wasn't a showing by the plaintiff at all that there was a violation of the order when it came to collecting the 12-month medical history, when you look at all of the circumstances in the case.
So, I mean, for instance, is it your position that the state would be in compliance if its non-compliance rate were 15%?
Well, we're saying there was no showing at all of noncompliance in this particular situation with the requirement to diligently gather the records or make an effort to diligently gather the records and then to make, you know, decisions based on records that appear to provide a basis for decision.
Well, would you argue that there's problematic compliance?
Not in this particular case. It wasn't shown that we didn't comply. In terms of a percent, if you had a situation where in absolutely nothing was done, there was no records gathered in, you know, a sizable number of cases, one would not consider that, I don't think, to be diligent action on them, unless perhaps it was documented that those denials were the result of a categorical refusal by the applicant and the providers to cooperate in gathering the records.
But, I mean, surely you cannot deny that there were undeniable problems. For example, the 15.4% of the applications where the application is, you know, denied on the same day that the MMRT requested additional information, or the 7.7%.
There were four cases that the judge felt the records appeared to be less complete, although the district judge didn't find that they were so incomplete as to violate the regulations or the consent decree. And we've talked about each of those four. We talked about two to some degree in this argument. And the one where there was the denial on the same day, the evidence we had was that there may have been a request for additional information, but the agency already had essentially the information that it was seeking in the file.
Isn't it a little bit like being a little bit pregnant?
Well, I think that each one of these situations is not necessarily unique, but, you know, each situation involves a person who has their own particular individual issues, problems, possibly disabilities to be found out. Each one is a little different, you know, who they've seen, what they've done, what kind of history. Sometimes, as in the case of the lady who went to the community hospital, the medical history appears to be extremely sparse. But there is a medical history, and it tells us, you know, something about that individual. The records are gathered. You know, determinations have to be made. In this particular situation, we simply submit that that the agency showed through the evidence that it presented in this case that that diligent efforts were made to attempt to obtain the records that they were supposed to obtain, and that when they made decisions, they had a file where they believed that they could make a, you know, valid decision in the case. Otherwise, they wouldn't have made, you know, a decision. And that there are some time pressures on them to get all of this done.
How do you think a plaintiff can if the plaintiff has the burden, how do you think that plaintiff can go about demonstrating that the state was not reasonably diligent in gathering medical records? We're talking about a...
Well, I think it could be done. One thing that I thought of when I was thinking about this argument was that, even without violating any confidentiality, most medical providers around the state are going to be in a position from one time or another to have been asked for medical records. You can find individuals like that, and you can ask them what the agency's been doing. Have they been doing the follow-ups, the first follow-up, the second follow-up? You know, have the things been
done
that are required?
You need a hearing.
And you can have a hearing.
Discovery. To follow your line of thought, how are we going to arrive at that without a fuller record than we have here?
You could have a hearing.
But we don't have a factual finding by the district judge at all on any of these records as being incomplete, do we?
No, we do not. And when you look at the evidence that we presented, we've explained in each case. We ask you that you affirm the district court.
Thank you, Mr. Steiner. Mr. Rose, what's your position on the question of whether we have any findings of incompleteness here? I know you want us to draw some implicit findings from the four, But in fact, the district judge has not made any findings of incompleteness. So would a hearing and a remand get to the heart of this?
Your Honor, it is not our position that a remand is necessary.
What's your position on whether there are any findings here on incompleteness, which is what your argument is? We have incomplete records. I appreciate that one can deduce from the argument that has a logical basis, but in fact, we're not the trial court.
Your Honor, there are no explicit findings on incompleteness. You're absolutely correct.
Isn't that the heart of this case? As you started your argument, wasn't that your point, that these records are incomplete?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And our position is that the facts are what they are in this case. Both parties submitted facts. Both parties submitted briefing. This case was submitted to the district court for all intents and purposes on the post-judgment version of a motion for summary judgment. The facts are what they are. The state has not demonstrated reasonable diligence, even though it had an opportunity to do so. And the mere fact that several of these applications were as grotesquely underdeveloped as they are is an undisputed fact in this case. So remand for an evidentiary hearing is not necessary in our position. The first prong of the state's argument is that this is a contempt petition and discretion should be afforded to the district court. The district court made at least what appears to be factual findings, and we take absolutely no qualm with any of those factual findings. The district court
What are the factual findings as you see it with regard to completeness in this record?
The district court indicated, even if it did not hold, that four of the files adduced during the random sampling were at least underdeveloped, that there were significant gaps in the development in these four applications. In addition to this, the district court indicated five other applications in which the state had opted for this summary form in lieu of actual medical records. In those five applications, as well as in the other four, where the primary underdevelopment was the fact that this form was incompleted, rather than the actual lack of medical records, or at least one of the manners in which it was underdeveloped. The district court then used these facts, or these factual findings, or whatever you wanted to call them, and indicated that there was still an open question as to whether a summary form may qualify as a complete medical history under federal regulations and the consent decree. That is 100% a question of law. That is regulatory interpretation. That is the interpretation of a consent decree. And although the state argues that this is not a clear-cut question of law, that is absolutely incorrect. If I were to sit down at my desk down in Indianapolis and write out a way for this 12-month medical record requirement to be made a part of federal regulations, I could not come up with a clear way to write this. The state
is just an adoption of the SSI requirement, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, that was the parties apparently agreed to that. It's a consent decree.
So the parties
it wasn't thought out. It was just an acceptance. Well, I shouldn't say thought out. It was just an acceptance of whatever SSI requires is going to be required in this program.
The parties agreed to that, and actual federal Medicaid regulations incorporated into Medicaid law. The fact of the matter is that a complete medical history is defined in these regulations as consisting of, at the very least, 12 months' worth of medical records.
I was going to ask you a question about this sample. Obviously, Marion County is largest county in the state.
Absolutely, Judge.
Is it the parties agreed that 26 samples would be... What would be the review to be made in this case?
The parties agreed to use a random sampling in lieu of our initial request, which was for all recent denials.
How did they arrive at 26?
Your Honor, we chose the letter C for recent denials in Marion County over a two-month span shortly after the filing of the contempt petition. It was a random way to choose files, and the state ultimately agreed, in lieu of providing additional files, that this would be a random sampling.
Do we have in the record what the number of applications in the 2 months in Marion County generally across the alphabet?
We do not have that in the record. We know that 40,000 applications are processed in Indiana each year. Of course, that includes both both approvals and denials of Medicaid applications. And the undisputed facts are that this is a statistically significant random sampling. However, this is simply not a case about numbers. It is not a case about statistics. It is a case about the state deciding that it does not have to collect actual medical records, that this summary form that it has created or sometimes simply scarce medical records suffices to satisfy all requirements of the consent decree. It has decided that a medical history is complete exactly when it says it's complete, and that is not what the consent decree says. That is not what federal regulations say. They argue that they have procedures in place in order to ensure that complete medical histories are developed. But that doesn't answer the second part of that question. Procedures in place as to what? If you have procedures in place to develop complete medical histories, we still need to know what you consider to be a complete medical history. And the undisputed fact in this case is that as made explicit in Courtney O'Neill's affidavit, is that the state considers a summary form to constitute a complete medical history.
Mr. Rose, in this 10-year-old case, when you attempted to settle earlier, was that to modify, was that going to speak to the modification of this adoption of the SSI requirement?
Your Honor, I certainly do not know that. I was not on this case at either the initial case or the original contempt petition.
I just wondered whether it tracks what we have in this case. That's all.
Sure. And the second consent decree in this case is not substantively different from the first, at least as it relates to this requirement.
What I would want to focus on a minute is when we talk about substantial compliance and reasonable diligence. You said 40,000 annually. What percentage of those are granted?
I apologize. I couldn't
hear
you.
What percentage of that 40,000 are approved?
Your Honor, I do not know that, and the record does not reflect that.
So we don't have any record or any knowledge of what percentage are rejected and what are approved?
We do not. What we know, however, is that the Social Security regulation at issue speaks only in terms of denials. It says before we decide that you are not disabled, we have to collect your complete medical history.
But I have to assume there are a lot of approvals. And they may be done just on the form.
I would assume the very same thing, Your Honor. It may be done just on the form. It may be done on the basis of a solitary medical record that says that you have cerebral palsy or multiple sclerosis. The fact of the matter is that before they deny an application, they have to collect these records in order to ensure that they have sufficient records in order to make a disability determination.
So again, back to substantial compliance and reasonable diligence regarding the contempt. Is this in the aggregate or with each individual? Because I can see where in the aggregate, if let's just say 80% are approved or they're not denied, I guess is a better way of putting it, then nobody scrutinized those or what the process is and what was needed in order to be not denied. When you look at these 26, apparently 17 were separated out as being adequate, at least. And so the other 9, I guess, are the ones in question. And if you focus on each of those individually, it would seem that's almost what it requires. It gets down to an individual thing and not the whole group. And I think when we're looking at the whole group, that's when I think the district court came down with said, well, it was reasonable compliance, I guess, and sufficient diligence.
Your Honor, the primary issue in this case is what exactly a complete medical history is.
For each individual. Because obviously, I'll bet a lot of them didn't have a complete. It just took it on its face value. Okay, he's got MS, therefore disabled. I happen to have that once. And it does vary with every individual.
Absolutely, Judge, but the requirement does not vary, and this is something that they are required to do in every single application. But when we look at complete medical history, what we're talking about here is the fact that the state has redefined this term away from what it means in Social Security regulations, away from how it is defined there. A single application of this policy, whether it's made to one individual, it represents an attempt not to collect 12 months' worth of medical records. Reasonable diligence must be assessed in the context, and we have certainly indicated that this is their burden, but must be assessed in the context of what they are trying to do, what they are trying to collect, what they are trying to accomplish.
Isn't the second issue whose burden is it? The district court has placed the burden on you.
I see that my time is out, Your Honor. May I answer?
Please answer.
The second issue is absolutely whose burden it is. However, insofar as we're talking about a policy that is violative of Social Security regulations, there can be no justification regardless for a policy that is in violation of controlling law. So quite frankly, it doesn't matter whose burden that rests on. The existence of a policy that does not even require a 12-month medical history suffices for a finding of contempt.
Well, just one more question, at least for me, and certainly my colleagues can ask others. But, Mr. Rose, do we have before us a sufficient record which speaks to a policy violation? In other words, let's assume that you've established in the nine, if not the five, less than complete, in the words of the district judge, I think, less underdeveloped. If she said less than complete, we might have a more specific, less implicit finding. But if the suggestion is that the Indiana Medicaid plan is violating a policy that had been agreed to in the consent decree, are 26 samples out of the largest county indicative, unless we're going to hold to, and I appreciate how strongly you feel about even one record being incomplete, but let's assume arguendo that there might be room for a small percentage, speaking to what Judge Rovner was inquiring about on substantial compliance. Do we have here with this, as I say, absence, in my view, of specific findings, something that speaks to whether there's a broad policy violation across the board? Well, we don't have an answer to Judge Mannion's inquiry. I'm not holding you accountable for that. As to the number of grants, the number of denials. I mean, do we have a full enough the record? Because this is a contempt proceeding, which, you know, carries with it special implications. And I just query whether we're confronted with that fullness of record.
I think we absolutely do, Judge. We have Courtney O'Neill's affidavit, which says we will accept one or the other. That is an unequivocal statement of this is what we do here at the Medicaid review team, and it is undisputed insofar as it was at least their professional coming forward with that. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you. Mr. Rose, thanks to all counsel, and we will take the case under advisement.